And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Hello, Phil. Good afternoon.
And today we're going to talk to an expert on Sudan because George Clooney has decided that we all should talk about Sudan. So we're going to talk about George Clooney and Sudan, and we're going to talk to David Hoyle, who is a professor both in at the university in Darfur and in Khartoum as well. So he is with the European Sudan. I'm going to get the rest of it for you. ESPAC.org are the letters. I'll get it all for you later. And later we'll talk to Sunshi Avlegis, and she is a student at McGill University. And if you haven't heard about it, there's a tremendous amount of student activity, demonstrations and marches and whatnot. And last November, the 50,000 demonstrated in Montreal against tuition hikes. So we're going to find out what is it about the water down there that just got these students in such a fighting trim. And then later we're going to talk to David Heap, who is one of the organizers of the Canadian boat to Gaza. But right now we are joined by David Hoyle. Are you there, David?
Yes, indeed, Phil. Good evening.
Good evening. Hey, thanks very much for staying up and talking to us. You are an old hand with the Sudan matter. You are a professor in Khartoum. You have published books on this, on the search for peace in Sudan. We're finding ourselves here with headlines in our papers and television appearances by a prominent Hollywood star, George Clooney. He is saying that, among other things, that the government of Sudan is starving or blocking, I should say, humanitarian aid for South Sudan. Is that true?
I'm not exactly sure if that is the case. First of all, the point I always like to make is that there are no real experts on Sudan, and indeed, actually, very very few experts on what's now happening in South Sudan. The whole Sudan issue has always been very much distorted by propaganda and disinformation. So it's always very difficult, even if you work in the country, it's actually very difficult to get a total a grip on what's happening.
Well, he himself, of course, has made himself the center of a lot of activity over the decade. I can recall when he was head of something called Enough, having to do with the Darfur matter. He seems to have set that aside, and now he's involved in South Sudan. And my understanding is that he went to the region recently. There was even a question of whether or not he was there legally. Have you followed what he's been doing and have an understanding of what he's what he's involved in?
One of the complications, of course, in Sudan now is about a year or so ago, South Sudan became independent and actually left the old state of Sudan and became independent in its own right. And that actually kicked off a number of interlinked conflicts, because the SPLA movement, the insurgent movement, which actually came to power in South Sudan, also had a number of guerrilla units and supporters who lived in the border region of what is now the rest of Sudan, I guess. We could call that actually Sudan as opposed to South Sudan. And these were armed organizations, armed parties. And perhaps unsurprisingly, the government of Sudan decided that they would rather not have armed factions actually belonging to a different party in a different state now, South Sudan, operating within these border regions. These are South Kordofan and Blue Nile State. So they actually began a process of demilitarizing those groups. And that, of course, in turn led to a number of incidents and quite some fighting in both of those states. And that all by itself, of course, as usual, has actually generated there are quite a few displaced people and refugees. Mm-hmm. And I think it's all within that issue that George Clooney has yet again focused on Sudan. He's not stopped his interest, of course, in Darfur, which again was equally questionable and equally misguided.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, you know, it really adds to all of our confusion for people who are trying to comprehend it and to propose to, for example, the Canadian government what their role ought to be. When he portrays it as an issue of Khartoum, the government of Khartoum, but he doesn't. Does he address the other? Now you have a second government.
You do. At the end of the day, what's always been very disturbing about the antics of people like George Clooney. Of course, he's not alone. There are also a number of Hollywood actors and actresses who've also taken up these issues. The difficulty is that it's always a very distorted, unbalanced, and largely one-sided picture. Yeah? And to the extent that even there are people who I'm sure you've also come across, people like Nina Shea from Freedom House's Center for Religious Freedom, who have been anti-Sudan, vigorously anti-Sudan for decades. I mean, really vociferously anti-Khartoum. And even, people like Shea have actually called what he does antics, and that he's actually quite partisan in what he does. And there's also a great quotation actually from her where she describes Clooney as quote, having a simplistic conception of foreign affairs and diplomacy. So, even those people who have been on the block for quite some time have very little patience for people like George Clooney. And even people, there are very few independent foreign experts on Sudan and Darfur. One of them, of course, I think we've actually discussed him before, is a British expert called Alex Duval.
Mm-hmm.
And, the point he makes is, that one way of looking at the issue of having celebrities on the issue, on a particular issue, is a balance sheet. And he makes the point that the plus side is obviously more aid, resources, and pressure. And, of course, the minus side, and I quote it, the minus side is an oversimplified and sometimes degrading portrayal of the situation and a stress on outside silver bullets, end quote.
And by the way, in some instances, they don't really mean silver, they mean bullets, right? I mean, Clooney carries with him always a kind of because of the aura of power that he has, since after all, Wednesday night he was at the White House with Prime Minister Cameron and President Obama, and the next day he's being arrested as a martyr for the great freedom fight. When he says something, it's almost threatening.
Well, that's right. And what, once again, you have this very blatant, very open contradiction, which is at the heart of George Clooney, because as you may well know, he was very opposed actually to the war in Iraq and the American intervention in the war in Iraq. And there was actually a great quote from him at the time saying, and I quote him again, he said, "Well, I think we have some questions to ask before we send 150,000 kids to get shot at." The irony is that that's exactly what he's actually pushing for with regards to Sudan, has been pushing for mm-hmm. regards to Sudan for the last 8 years or so. And he wants to have Western ground forces on the ground.
He's able to say different things at different times because he is an actor.
Well, he is, and
he's just reading lines.
And my wife actually won't thank me for this, because obviously, as all wives are, she's very much a fan of George Clooney. Openly, but he's not the brightest of the actors. I think we have had some much brighter actors in circulation. So he's I think in many ways the characters he actually portrays do actually mirror him. But what he's done on the issue of Darfur, and now what he's doing on the issue of events on the border region between North and South, is he's basically doing exactly what he calling for a crusade,
yes.
Which, you know, well, that's just not going to solve anything in Africa, and certainly not in Sudan. It'll make matters infinitely worse.
Mm-hmm. And, certainly a concern. We're speaking to David Hoyle. He is with the European Sudan Public Affairs Council. That's ESPAC.org, a very important site where people should go. He's the author of The Search for Peace in Sudan. David, this area, South Kordofan, and the second area where there seems to be troubles, the so-called
Blue
Nile province. Now, are these areas, when the new state of South Sudan was created, were these unresolved matters, or is this somebody in violation of an agreement? What is this?
Excuse me. Well, as I mentioned, it's actually quite a complex issue. The agreement, which was signed in 2005, which ended Africa's longest-standing civil war in Sudan itself, the comprehensive peace agreement, agreed that there would be a referendum on whether South Sudan left Sudan, which was actually held, I think, 2 years ago. And was to be done on the basis of the old border between North and South, the 1956 border. And there's no doubt, and everyone's accepted it, that South Kordofan and Blue Nile State are well within the north of Sudan. What there actually is, though, is that a number of issues, for whatever reason, and it's very, very dangerous, a number of issues were left unresolved. And one of those issues is a lozenge of land, which is called Abyei, which is actually within northern Sudan, but is largely populated, our friends in the south claim, by certain tribes from the south. And this issue is not resolved. So you have a number of hundreds of kilometers of a border which have not yet been fixed. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an open wound. There's no doubt about that. You've had some very intensive, actually, fighting in the last year or two in and around that area. And that, once again, has actually generated, thousands of refugees.
With the tribal elements in that region, would someone be using them as a cat's paw? I mean, is this a way? Is the only army engaged the army of Sudan proper, or North Sudan?
Well, I mean, the sad thing is that actually that whole region is actually awash with comparatively well-armed militias. And there's no doubt about that. North of the border and south of the border. In South Sudan itself, ever since independence, you've had, I think at last count, maybe 8 or 9 fully armed and largely tribal militias in existence already waging a war.
Sounds like Libya.
South Sudan. Well, yes, it does, but on a far more organized basis than I think is what's happening in Libya. So,
larger.
And a number of these militia are based in the north, as it were, of South Sudan. And, they are against the government of South Sudan for whatever reasons, wealth-sharing reasons or ethnic mm-hmm. reasons. And there's no doubt they've also now been caught up in this whole, north-south issue. And there's allegations that Khartoum, of course, is actually encouraging them in the north of South Sudan, and it's a terrible mess,
mm-hmm.
And,
well, and there seems to be big power meddling. And, Mr. Clooney, of course, once again, he is, by the way, a powerful figure in the Democratic Party.
Absolutely.
And with maybe even with possibility of becoming a senator and actually taking on a clear political role. We hear that sometimes in editorial form that this is a kind of a proxy situation where the hope of Washington and London is to remove the Chinese from the area as a competitor for the resources. Is there anything to that?
Oh, that's a fact, absolutely. But I think it actually
that's
predates
an
that because
thank you.
what you had in Sudan, excuse me, from 1989 onwards, in effect, and certainly into the mid 1990s, was you had one of the first Islamist governments in the world, really, and certainly in that part of the world. And by Islamist, I don't mean Taliban. I mean a government which was actually brought into being based on Islamist politics rather than theology as such. Mm-hmm. And, of course, our friends in Washington actually took against it almost immediately. So you've had a number of groupings and constituencies in Washington who have sought to split up Sudan, to actually dismember Sudan. And, of course, there's a strong school of thought now within the north of Sudan, what actually remains of the original state, that they've actually been very successful in bringing about the independence of South Sudan. And the continuing focus on Darfur, of course, is also perceived in that light as one more effort to actually chop up what remains of Sudan. So, yes, there's a large amount of geopolitics.
And a last question is that how it's perceived by the, let's say, the politically people who follow politics in Sudan? Do they understand that this is the game?
Yes, they do. But what you also have, which I think is even more worrying, is the government within Sudan, and I've actually watched it now for 15 or 16 years very closely, has for the negative portrayal of it, it's always been very keen to engage with the West. It's made up largely of people who went to university in the West, and especially within the United States. Okay. These are people who were desperate, for whatever reason, to engage with the West and come back into the actual community of nations.
Yeah.
So they made this deal in 2005, a comprehensive peace agreement, expecting rewards for it, and in effect, absolutely nothing has happened. In fact, actually, quite the contrary. So you now have a conservative grouping, I think, actually within Sudan, within Khartoum, especially within the military, who are saying, well, we've made all these concessions, we've jumped through infinitely large numbers of hoops, and all we've received, in effect, is that we've lost a third of our country and 80% of our oil wealth, which, of course, is all based in southern Sudan. And, enough is enough. And this is also one reason why the events in Kordofan and in Brunei are so visceral, because these people are saying enough is enough. Mm-hmm. The SPLA have their own government in South Sudan. We will no longer accept armed groups of the SPLA within our sovereign territory. So, there's a conservative reawakening, which is not going to be in the best interest of the West, and they will look west. They will look east. There's no doubt about it. Even more so now than they have already.
Wow, that is very interesting analysis. David Hoyle, European Sudan Public Affairs Council, ESPAC.org, a terrific site. David, thank you very, very much. That's very enlightening.
Not at all.
Okay. Bye bye.
Thanks.
It sounds like in Sudan they have enough of the Enough Project. Or they are answering for it. Now, we'll be talking to McGill student and actually a good friend. I think she's a friend of our program. She used to be at McMaster. She's now at McGill, Sunchi Avlegis. And we'll find out about that situation. But Phil, I don't know if you noticed, but the National Post has endorsed Smoke Care and told everybody to get with it, and the Toronto Star. So we have the voice of the Conservative Party, and we have the voice of the Liberal Party telling the NDPers what to do. And you know what? The NDPers are going to do as they're told.
They certainly appear to be that now. I saw an interesting analysis today of how many times Smoke Care's name has appeared in a headline in the Star in the past 8 days compared to the other leadership candidates. Surprise, surprise. You take all of the names combined, and they haven't appeared in a headline as often as Mulcair's has. So it's sort of like it's being presented to NDP members.
They do know what they're doing,
don't they? Yes, they certainly do.
Yeah. Yeah. And we are joined now by Sunchi Avlegis, as she is at McGill University. She's been part of all this student activity. They are fighting vigorously against a tuition, extreme raising of the tuition figure in Quebec. Are you there?
Yes. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm good.
Hey, by the way, there's some good sites I want to just mention right at the top that you provided to us. One is Munaca.com, M-U-N-A-C-A.com. Then that's a union of non-academic workers who are supporting the students and
McGill,
the teachers' assistant teaching assistants union statement. And I'll give that out later. But Sunchi, I've never heard of a student activity such as this in this part of this neck of the woods. Is it true there were 50,000 last fall demonstrated in Montreal?
Yes, and on November 10th, it was a huge student demonstration. It was after they announced that the tuition was going to go up. It was basically the students kind of giving the government a last warning to go back on this decision before they started mobilizing for the strikes that are happening right now.
And you're at McGill. I know that the other side seems to be trying to make a sort of an example, right? I mean, it seems rather severe. I read on one of the sites that you recommended that the police have been on the campus and students have been roughed up. Can you talk about it?
That's right. So the first time that happened was after that large demonstration a number of times. A number of McGill students came back on our campus and they wanted to make a statement, especially about our administrators lobbying for these tuition increases, and so they entered our gym's administration building, and eventually the riot police were brought on the McGill campus, and I mean, not only did they pepper spray and beat the students who were protesting outside of the building, but a lot of people got caught up, and you know, professors who were just walking through campus and on their way to the daycare to pick up their kids were beaten, and so there was a big thing around that.
This past weekend, you had, I guess, a convergence of issues. You had the students with the tuition issue, and then you had the population of Montreal with the police brutality issue.
Right. There's the annual anti-police brutality protest, which also happened last week, and students participated in it overwhelmingly. I mean, and the overwhelming number of students who are on strike participated in it. Because these two issues kind of come together. Whenever there is a large student demonstration, the police are out there, and they didn't really hold back. A couple of weeks ago, there was another student demonstration where the police threw a sound grenade into the crowd, and the shrapnel hit a Cégep student's eye, and he was in danger of losing his eye. So it's getting pretty rough on that side of things. And now we're expecting enormous numbers of people to come out this Thursday.
What kind of event do you think it'll be? Would it be speeches, a rally? What's it going to be like?
So there will be speeches, and then we will march throughout downtown Montreal for the day. And, I mean, they were expecting 50,000 on November 10th. Right now we have over 200,000 students who are on unlimited strike. And so we're expecting even larger numbers on Thursday. So,
everybody ought to recognize you have one of the most successful student movements in Canada. Over the years, the tradition is they've been able to fight for student rights and to maintain rate for on tuitions for students in Quebec than anywhere else in Canada. But that's because you have 200,000 people willing to demonstrate.
Exactly, because students in Quebec understand that we can go, if we commit to going on general unlimited strikes, that we can put enough pressure in the government, economic pressure, to make them change their mind about, trying to force students to take the brunt of the bill for paying for education. And you know, quite often we get criticized, well, you guys have it easy. You have the lowest tuition in the country anyways. Why are you complaining? Well, the reason we have the lowest tuition and we're going to keep it that way is because we know that we can, we support accessible education, and we know that we can pressure the government to respect those wishes.
And you make it possible for students, working students, people, and I understand the figures are something like 80% of the students work. You make it possible for them to go to university. If the tuition rates climb, it's going to happen as it did in, we're seeing it across North America, where, frankly, it becomes an enclave for the wealthy.
Yes, exactly. And basically, they did the IRIS, which is the Institut de Recherche et d'Information Socio-Économique, did some calculations that if the tuition goes up, it will take 8.8 weeks of working minimum wage to pay just for tuition if the tuition hikes go up, which, you know, if you take into account how much living expenses are, it will make it pretty impossible for a lot of students to continue their studies.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of students in Quebec understand this, and they understand it, and they don't feel disempowered. We've seen these student strikes be successful in the past, and that's why they're able to mobilize and to put this pressure. In fact, this time, the strike, with the numbers that we have now and the numbers we're expecting by Thursday, is probably going to be the largest student strike in Quebec history.
Man, that's got to be something. By the way, we're going to have to do a follow-up with you. We want to hear about this because it is an inspiration. You know, people right across North America, actually in Europe, they hear about this. I mean, demonstrations of this size cannot be ignored.
Right, that's right. And I mean, and there have been demonstrations in Montreal almost on, you know, on a daily basis. There's something going on every day. And I mean, I did my undergraduate in Ontario, and I just remember being a student there, and it's completely different. You know, mm-hmm. if something like that happens in Ontario, it would be in the news, but here it happens so much that you don't even hear half of the things that are happening in Montreal and in Quebec.
We're speaking to Suchi Avligis. She's at McGill, and she has a partner going to participate in demonstration coming up Thursday. What about the support in terms of politics or unions? Do they attend these rallies, and what do they tell you?
Yes, so, you know, in Quebec, this is really a social movement, not just a students' movement. The two large labor unions in Quebec, the CSN and the CSU, they represent 500,000 workers. They have come out publicly in support of the student unlimited strike, and they're encouraging their members to come out to our demonstration on Thursday. So, because they understand that this is part of a larger group of austerity measures that the Quebec provincial government is attempting to implement. And, you know, it affects Quebec families. It's not just about, you know, this one segment of the population who are students at the moment.
Mm-hmm. For example, on Thursday, you probably have representatives of the major unions there?
Yes, yeah. For sure, at least CSN and CSU. But, I mean, on November 10th, there were unions on that occasion as well.
Do the parties speak up? Will there be somebody from the political parties? Will they show up? Or what about that?
I have not heard about that. Actually, I'm not sure.
That's always a big question, of course, when rallies are held. Should you allow politicians to get in front of a crowd? Unions are a natural, of course.
Yes.
By the way, the propaganda campaign they're waging against you, they seem to be running for office. Raymond Bashan, the finance minister, he uses the expression, he says, the students have to pay their fair share. I mean, obviously, he's trying to talk over your head fairness is a pretty fluid word. How do students respond to that when they hear that?
Well, we think that, for one thing, we already pay our fair share. We pay as much as we are able to. And universities are more than just an individual's investment. They're good for society. They're good for Quebec society. They're good for even the corporations in Quebec who look at the universities as basically a gold mine. That's what they call them at the Montreal Board of Trade. It's a quote. And
now they want to own the mine, though, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So students, for one thing, when we graduate and we get jobs, we pay taxes and we pay back into the education system, and students and research at universities contribute to society. We do care, and we do already pay tuition. Don't want to pay 75% more. And there is this movement of privatizing universities to move the funding away from public funding to private funding through funding by students and private corporations. So we don't think that that's the best for our public education system.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Sinchi, we were very grateful you had the time. We look forward to actually talking to you in the near future, because obviously this is a battle that's going to go on for a while. And,
right, and we're really hoping that I'm very positive about this being successful, and we really hope that, you know, what we would like students who are listening in Ontario to get from this is that, you know, to take it almost as an inspiration to, so that we don't get told that our tuition is too low. They should be recognizing that their tuition is too high. You know, everybody should be aiming to bring it down. Not
it's like the daycare situation in Quebec, which it's the envy of the country. So everybody should get with it. Try to match that.
And one last thing I just wanted to add. I know sometimes it feels hard to, you know, mobilize students at universities where it doesn't, you know, that there's not this tradition that there is in Quebec, but McGill University has traditionally been pretty silent, and there has never been an unlimited strike voted in McGill before this year. The Graduate Students Association has never gone up. This is the first 3-day strike for the Graduate Students Association as well. So it is possible if people feel strongly about it, and it can happen. So
I bet it can. Sinchi Avligis, thank you very, very much. We look forward to talking to you again.
I was really glad to talk to you. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
And by the way, go to the site Munaca, M-U-N-A-C-A .com, and that is the Union of Non-Academic Workers. And we're going to take a break. We'll come back. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.fm, or check us out, Taylor-Report.com. See you on the other side. And we're back, just like I warned you. This is the Taylor Report. Hey, by the way, this is with 25 and counting anniversary of CIUT, which produces all the great programming. I mean, when George Clooney says something, by golly, we go and find somebody who actually knows what he's talking about to help him with his homework. And we're going to be talking shortly with David Heap, who is doing a... This guy's been in some adventures, and we're going to be finding out about that. And, Phil, I just want to mention... Oh, yeah, you have an announcement.
Right, and it's a good lead-in to David Heap. Bets Attune on Saturday afternoon, actually, 2 o'clock, Saturday, March the 24th, the Global March to Jerusalem. This is a fundraiser for Eva Bartlett. Eva is being sent by supporting groups here in Canada, and there's many of them, to an international march in Jerusalem on March the 30th. And it says 1 million people are expected to take part worldwide to oppose Israeli apartheid, ethnic cleansing, and to demand access to Jerusalem for all peoples and to uphold Palestinian rights, including the refugees' right of return. So this is a fundraiser for Eva Bartlett. It's on Saturday, March the 24th at Bet's Attune, 612 Markham Street. And you pay what you can, obviously.
Did you say 12?
12, 2 p.m., sorry.
2 p.m. And the address?
Is 612, 612 Markham Street.
Great.
Right.
Thanks for a lot, very much. And now we're joined by David Heap. I always want to call you Dan Heap, but a legendary figure.
It's happened before.
And I know you're not offended at all. No. David, you're going to be in Toronto Sunday, March 25, 1 to 3 p.m. at the Steelworkers Hall, and that's at 25 Cecil Street.
That's right,
and
it's on campus.
And, yeah, it's very, by the way, it's a great location. Sunday at 1 to 3, March 25. Now, you're going to be providing a firsthand account of the capture at sea of the Canadian boat to Gaza.
That's right.
Is Ihab Lataif is also going to be there?
That's right. Yeah. So there's two of us that were delegates on the Tahrir in November when we were trying to sail to Gaza and stopped by Israeli occupation military on the in international waters on the Mediterranean.
Yeah. So you met the pirates of the Mediterranean.
We did. The state pirates. State pirates brought to you in part by our own. Whatever you call them in Ottawa. Yeah, there's probably family radio this time of year. I can't really say what we think about the guys in Ottawa. But, state pirates with the backing of the Harper's government in Ottawa captured us in our boat and took us off our course. We were headed for Gaza, and they took us to the Israeli port of Ashdod and detained us for 6 days.
Well, now, by the way, you, the Canadian boat, and I guess there were two boats, so it was the Irish boat as well.
Yep, there's the Saoirse as well, the Irish book.
You really ought to be congratulated in your seamanship, because you manage, actually, there had been a number of boats that never got out of harbor.
Yeah.
But you managed to make a good run for it.
We did make a very good run for it, and I think it's important that people realize that though we didn't get to Gaza, we broke the first line of the blockade, because since early this year, I was with the group that was in Greece in June and July, mm-hmm. and what happened in June and July was that the Israeli blockade of Gaza was outsourced from Palestinian waters off Gaza to the ports of Europe in Greece and to a lesser extent in Turkey. That outsourced blockade meant that, and we'll be talking about that a bit as well, meant that basically Israel has third party, other states, in this case Greece, doing their bidding and enforcing their blockade for them. So the fact that we were able to leave a port of Europe, we actually left from a Turkish port in November, and reach international waters and travel most of the way to Gaza, was itself an act of challenging and defying that illegal blockade of mm-hmm. Gaza.
Speaking to David Heap, and David, I want to ask you, given all the turmoil in the region, and mm-hmm. by the way, again, I congratulate all of you on your abilities, and particularly there's the turbulent politics. One of our leaders, so-called, Bob Ray, has complained that anyone would discuss Israel at a time like this, when we should all be getting behind Arabs, mm-hmm. and indeed arming the Arabs, mm-hmm. got to arm them, and we have to bomb some of them. He's very offended that folks like yourself would be focusing on Gaza and the illegal occupation of the West Bank. Can you talk about how you react
about priorities?
Yes, priorities.
Well, of course, for people like Mr. Ray, it's never a good time to talk about Israel, right? I mean, mm-hmm. there's never been a time when he's thought it was a good idea to talk about the Israeli occupation, either of the West Bank or of Gaza. So, it's a bit disingenuous for him to say it shouldn't be now. He's happy to have the distraction. People like him are happy to have a distraction to point at, but they've never been comfortable talking about the occupation and the illegal presence of the Israeli military in these areas. Mm-hmm. We named the boat the Tahrir, in full recognition of what was going on in the Arab Spring a year ago January now. So we're clearly, in solidarity with all the stuff that's happening in the Arab world, which it's a wonderfully dynamic situation. It's evolving all the time. You know, some of it more wonderful than others. I mean, the stuff in Syria not so good. When I go to events here in my community, I've been to a number over the last year for Syria. I've been to events in Syria when I've been in other communities as well. We always make the point that Tahrir isn't an Egyptian name. It's a universal human value of liberation. And while this vote is focusing on Gaza, it really is a universal human value of liberation that applies across the Arab world and across, we're in need of liberation here in North America as well.
That's a great new word.
Yeah, but specifically, why Gaza, why now? I think people have to realize that the closure of Gaza is, first of all, is clearly illegal in international law. It's supported by our government. And the reason that Canadians need to notice this is, we're not the ones keeping... Canada's been complicit with the thugs in Syria and in Libya and other places over the years. But Canada is not the one keeping those governments in power. Canada is in the front lines of the people keeping the Israeli occupation, legitimate in whatever legitimacy it has in the international community, right? Mm-hmm. Canada is, under Stephen Harper, the most pro-Zionist country in the world, and they're very proud of that, and they congratulate themselves on that when jokers like, Minister Baird goes to Israel, and he's talking, he talks like he's a minister of the Israeli government more than he's a minister of the Canadian government.
He would blush with satisfaction to hear you say that.
I'm sure he would, but we need to realize that our government, we are responsible very directly
Indeed.
For our government's actions in complicity with the Israeli blockade of Gaza. So we have a particular responsibility here above and above our general responsibility to sisters and brothers in Syria and everywhere else.
Well, by the way, all these people, we had this wonderful movement, and let us hope it revives and isn't beaten down, but the Occupy people, mm-hmm. They need to occupy our foreign policy, don't they? I mean,
absolutely.
Shouldn't we be saying, is that really a Canadian policy to
absolutely.
Intercept a Canadian boat?
Yeah, exactly. And to tell us, as we've been told by Canadian, the Department of Foreign Affairs, we can't do anything to help you. That's a private matter for you to take up. They won't even put us in touch with their counterparts of the Israeli Foreign Ministry. So they're doing, if it was possible to do less than nothing, that's what they're doing mm-hmm. to help this And again, it's not our campaign. This is a boat that belongs, was bought with the help of and belongs to Canadian civil society. This is a boat that was representative of the 99%. The donations that came for this came from people digging into their pockets at union halls and houses of worship and on campus groups and community groups across the country that organized events to raise the funds to buy this boat. So it's not a slap in the face, not just to the group of us in the Canadian Boat de Gaza, but to literally thousands of people in Canadian civil society across the country who bought this boat and, you know, want to know why the Canadian government isn't representing our interests when we want it to continue and deliver its cargo to Gaza.
Yeah. Well, how about also recognizing their own Canadian interest in protection of international law, the
Absolutely.
Laws of the high seas?
Absolutely.
You know,
this is, you know, a flagrant violation of international law. You know, no state has the authority to do this extraterritorially, you know, in international waters. And, you know, a vessel of any flag should be a concern to any of us. I mean, if this is, many people have pointed out, if this happened off the coast of Somalia, people would be all over these pirates. But, you
yes.
know, when the pirates happen to have an Israeli flag, then people view it differently.
Yes. No, that is, I'm really glad this whole matter is being addressed. By the way, there is a website, tahrir.ca, T-A-H-R-I-R.ca, where you can
yeah.
follow the work of Ehab Latoyev and David Heap and others and get all the details. So you're going to be, and you'll be here Sunday, March 25?
This Sunday at 1 o'clock at the Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil. And at the website, tahrir.ca, I'm glad you mentioned that, because whether we'd love to see all of your listeners out on Sunday and everybody, all of their friends and acquaintances, they can tell about it. But if, by chance, some of your listeners can't make it, one of the things you'll find at our website is our declaration and call on the Canadian government, which is simply a call on the Canadian government to respect international law, call for the return of the Tahrir, allow us to continue our voyage, complete our voyage, and to call on the Canadian government to press Israel to respect international its obligations under international law and lift the blockade. Because ultimately, what happened to us, yes, was a crime, but what happens day in, day out, year in, year out to the Palestinians of Gaza is an ongoing crime that we have to continue to draw attention to.
Yeah. Well, David Heap, that's a well put. And people should, they should print that up and go knock on their MP's door.
Absolutely. Don't take no for an answer. Ask them why. You know, why does international law apply to some people and not to others?
Very good. Well, we look forward to seeing you.
Okay. Thank you so
All
much,
right.
Phil.
Thank you.
Appreciate
David.
It. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye.
That's David Heap, and he is an academic in London, Ontario. That's Tahrir, T-A-H-R-I-R.ca. And it's going to be a firsthand account of capture at sea of the Canadian boat to Gaza. And they're good sailors. They almost got through. That's good for them. We need a stronger Navy, it sounds like, to protect international waters. We're going to be, let's see, we've announced what we have to announce. And, Phil, we have a book we've got to talk about.
Yes, Soldiers for Sale.
Soldiers for Sale, the German mercenaries with the British in Canada during the American Revolution, 1776-1783, for those of you who forgot about it, but Soldiers for Sale is a good title. But, you know, before we do that, I want to make sure I quote one more thing from Mr. Mulcair, who the National Post and the Toronto Star say we must elect or otherwise we're no good. Elect as leader of the NDP. He said, I hadn't realized he said this, you'll never hear me speaking against the development of the oil sands. This is from the Toronto Star on Saturday. Did you know that? That's pretty kind of stark, isn't it?
There you go. At least truth in advertising.
Circles I travel in, they would say, really?
If you thought this was an issue, well, Thomas Mulcair will explain to you. This is not an issue.
Not an issue. Yeah. Tar is good for you. Yeah. Anyhow, Phil, back to the book, Soldiers for Sale. You liked the book, and so did I, but tell me about who this author is. How do you pronounce that name?
Oh, well, I'm going to take a guess and say that Jean-Pierre Wilhelmy.
You do a little German.
But in German, I wouldn't know what to do with the Y at the end of it. It'd be Wilhelm and the letter Y. But he tells an interesting story, and he did the research for this book. He actually wrote this book back in the 1980s and 90s. It's just been published in English, which is why we're reviewing it now, and by Baraka Books in Montreal, which publishes
Baraka
a
Books.
Lot of books in English for the first time. is that he said he couldn't get any answers from his own relatives about the about this odd.
If we're so French, why do we have a
right,
German
odd
name?
Family name, right? So he just decided to find out about it. And one of the many interesting things in this book, which really meanders along wonderfully, is that he has a list of all of the German names that became part of.
Give
of,
us that big one.
Of Quebec life. Wagner, of course.
Yeah.
And there used to be a politician in Quebec. I used to wonder about the guy.
He was a major leader. What was it, Liberal Party? I forget.
Conservatives. He was Brian Mulroney's mentor. His name was Claude Wagner. He was a
Wagner.
Judge. He was very right-wing, as I remember, too.
was Wagner.
So was Well, we won't go there. But
In his youth, he was okay. We won't go there either. Yeah.
What is very interesting in this book, Phil, there's a chart that I found in this book which just opened up a whole area of thought about the American Revolution. So I've developed a new theory, by the way, which is that the Americans have the Irish to thank.
Everybody, get your notebooks out.
Right.
Yes, go ahead.
Because in this chart, the author sets the stage for why these German troops were in Quebec. He says, well, the British were having a hard time filling up the ranks of their army. For one thing, it was costing them money. Parliament was complaining. They'd just been through a long war with the French. They were broke. But in this chart, which is early in the book, he publishes the figures of where the British Army is deployed on the eve of the American uprising. And surprise, surprise, one quarter of the British Army is deployed in Ireland, a comparatively small, compact island.
Shows they're more attached
with
to
only
Ireland
one major city, right?
They really like the Irish.
And they had more troops in Ireland than they had in the 13 colonies. And that kind of tells you that they were a little worried. And they were right to be worried because shortly after the American Revolution, the Irish had a little hand at it as well and got crushed by overwhelming numbers.
Yes.
But
1798.
So that's right. But the British didn't have those overwhelming numbers in North America. And so the English king, and they didn't have the money to pay for recruits. So the British king goes to his cousins, who are all these princes in these little feudal states in Germany. Some of these states, these guys are called landgraves and margraves, and these are all really interesting titles, but these are the lowest levels of nobility. They're basically, you know...
Still above my family.
Well, anyway, but you know what? I mean, they're basically like little neighborhood gangs. That's really what they amount to.
And they rented the gang.
And they rented out their soldiers. And nobody volunteered for this assignment. They were just told, you're coming off the land, you're not going to farm your little miserable...
But you know, Phil, you touched something very important, and it's apropos of our crisis in Afghanistan and elsewhere. As he points out, there is an argument on the, did they want to go or
interesting
not.
Interesting argument.
And he
isn't
says,
it?
Of course, for a poor kid on a peasant, it might be at least a chance. Yeah. So he takes a gun and goes to hurt somebody else. And also, he tends to run away. He gets away from the land. And he runs for it.
A very good point.
And you know that the British had a problem here because they with desertion before the War of 1812. They had very high desertion rates because, of course, they weren't paying them anything, and the Americans were offering them land. Incidentally, land was offered here, right?
Absolutely.
People were offered, you stick around and we'll give you acreage.
Well, and that's part of the story. There wasn't an awful lot of fighting in Quebec after the first year or two of the revolution. Most of the fighting was well to the south of it. So these particular Hessians, that's the subject of this book, and I'm sorry, they're called the Hessians because that's a kind of a generic term. Many of the principalities that came from were part of the land of Hesse. These particular ones didn't see a lot of military action, integrated with the local communities because the British told the local communities, you're going to put them in your houses. And
yes.
So they put them in their houses, and many of them married the local girls, right, and stayed, right, and brought their family names.
So we get Claude Wagner.
All kinds of interesting people. And, of course, in the midst of dragooning all of these peasants into the army, they actually dragooned – there was a type around in the 18th century that's still around, a long-haired hippie soldier wandering through the countryside trying to find himself. Well, he found himself dragooned into these armies, so he kept a diary.
There'd be a great – surely somebody should make a Canadian film about this.
Absolutely.
This German kid who ends up in Quebec.
And then, of course, my special love, classical music. The very first classical music teacher recorded in the history of what is Canada, was one of these soldiers who stayed on in Quebec City, lived a very, very long life, and established the first music school. Wow. And actually, there's a museum in Quebec that has all of his scores and his instruments and stuff like that.
What's his name?
I've got to go back to the book.
You see, you never know. That's not fair.
And you do that all the time, but that's okay. Yeah. But that's all right. But if you read the book, folks, got
to
read the book.
Yeah, you have to get the book. It's called Soldiers for Sale.
I'm not making up that story. Is really Soldiers for Sale. Well,
now, was he dragooned? How did he end up? How did they get him to come over? Was he an officer?
Well, I think he was an officer, and in some cases, the officers were encouraged to stay. In some cases, the Landgrave wanted them back because he wanted to put them back running his estates. And there were some political problems. Some of them were supposed to go home, didn't want to. Some of them wanted to go home.
Right?
Yeah, but maybe less than half, but a very substantial number.
Incidentally, as Soldiers for Sale by Jean-Pierre Villamy points out, that some of those princes back home did not really want those soldiers to come back.
Because they had acquired some skills, for one.
And it's a wonderful letter. And incidentally, you know, when you say, well, should I buy a book? You should buy the book just to find this letter that has been translated, written by one of these wonderful princes over in Germany.
Because he's complaining that
he's complaining that the British have the casualty count too low. He said more of my soldiers have died than they're reporting, and that's because they don't want to pay me. He said that we lost three times that many, that much. And he says, I need that money. There's a woman I got to marry in Italy. She's going to cost a fortune. He says, I needed that money. And the British are not counting my soldiers as dead, and I know they're dead.
And because I just read the book, I can tell you that letter really isn't in this book.
It's kind of like someone who organized scabs for a living, and his personal, the diary of a scab herder. By the way, again, the title is Soldiers for Sale. And it's Jean-Pierre Willamy, and it's Baraka Books. And the subtitle is German Mercenaries, quotes around the word mercenaries, with the British in Canada during the American Revolution. And they give us the date, in case we forgot, 1776 to 1783. And Phil, you mentioned a phenomenon that I think really ought to be underlined. The Americans, part of the reason for having the Revolution was that the British Army stayed in their homes by law.
Yes.
They said, well, we don't have enough room for our soldiers, so they're going to live with you. And they even wrote it into their Bill of Rights, says you can't put soldiers in private homes. That was a big deal. Well, when they rebelled, they, of course, these so-called Prussians, did I say Prussian? No. Hessians were put in the homes of the French population.
Right. That's right.
And can you imagine, these are German speakers, they're being put into the home of French families, and those French families, after all, have only been under British authority for about 12, 15 years.
That's right. And
welcome to the British. And the British were not kidding. They said, you didn't like us, this is what you get.
Yeah,
that's what they told them.
And of course, there's a religious difference, too. Most of the Hessians are Protestants. These are Catholic homes. That led to some interesting things, because when a lot of them
married,
led to
a lot of Catholic practices.
It did. By the way, Phil, you used the word Prussians. And there are no Prussians in this story, and that's because Frederick the Great told all these little princelings, you guys are a disgrace. You're absolutely a disgrace. Why do you let the English king tell you what to do? What is it? Are you Germans or are you not? Right? Because, the English king was there. Well, he was a German too, of course, and so they liked his money.
And this is a great story. Catherine the Great was involved. One of her brothers.
Well, that's a funny story too.
Brother-in-law, actually, who they identify as crazy. Which we always do that with our royals, because about one third to one half are somewhat odd, as people say. And at any rate, her half brother was the one who was complaining that his soldiers had been killed and he wanted the money. Mm-hmm. But she also was skeptical about all this.
Yeah, and she actually, when she was asked by the British if she would provide troops, and she, of course, gave a very funny answer. She said, surely the great British Empire is not having problems with mere colonials.
where we, the Russians, have to send our troops to rescue your bacon. It is a great story. If you want to comprehend Canadian history, Quebec history, American history, we're back to the subject of which Alan Taylor, the great author on the War of 1812, he says, we've been waging wars of cousins.
Yeah, by the way, there was...
And you need to read this kind
there,
of book.
There was an interesting little fact that he threw in at the end, that some of these Hessian princelings' territory did reach into the fringes of Alsace, which, of course, became a flashpoint for wars in later times. But the Germans in Alsace also spoke French. And so they, of course, were very comfortable when they were brought over. And they thought, you know, compared to what we have back there, this is a good life. And we really don't want to go back, right?
Yes. A couple of their letters is about what they're eating. Yeah. So for those, if you want to know, they said, ooh, wow, venison. Yeah. They said, it's very good. Well, thanks very much, Phil. Soldiers for Sale by Jean-Pierre Villamy, and it's Baraka Books. You really ought to get a copy of this. I want to say it somewhat near the closing. The email story involving the president of Syria has been called a hoax, by the way. And people should know who's doing this. A very qualified gentleman who has a website called The Angry Arab, Abu Khalil, a professor in California, he's starting at his website to demonstrate the flaws in the story. And it's been a very powerful propaganda story. It made the front pages at CNN. He says it's a hoax. It's very well done. And he says the people behind the hoax are the U.S. government. That's why it's been very well done. And he reminds us that we had the story of the girl who'd been cut into four pieces and identified by her family. Turned out she's actually alive and well. Toronto Star gave us that as the front page. Then we had the girl called the lesbian of Damascus. Turned out that she was a colonel in U.S. Air Force, retired. And the guy running the website also was a male U.S. Air Force, retired. So watch out for these stories. Most of them are bunk. So this has been, we're getting near the end. One last thing, yes, on the Clinton family. She says the man in Afghanistan who killed 16 civilians, they said that's not who we are. Well, the president of the United States killed a guy, in a U.S. citizen, using a drone, so I guess that's who he was. So we can stop with this stuff about he's not representative. He just seems to be an outstanding representative. So you've been listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and check us out, taylor-report.com. Carol, thank you very much, and Phil, and remember that book, Soldiers for Sale. See you next week.